Welcome to the Parliamentary Podcast Series, Partnering for Global Impact, presented by the Parliamentary Network on the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. The podcast is brought to you in partnership with the Parliamentary Engagement Teams of the World Bank and IMF. Join us as we engage in discussions with leading development experts and parliamentarians from around the world. Together, we'll explore how we can take decisive action to achieve a world free of poverty on a livable planet. Now, please welcome your host, Liam Byrne, Chairman of the Parliamentary Network.
Axel, thank you so much for joining us. You've been a very long-standing friend of the Parliamentary Network. We're incredibly grateful for you sustaining that engagement over many, many years. You've got a huge background and track record in development and here at the bank. And I was reflecting with Kristalina this morning that in my brief time of involvement, I've gone through crash, conflict, contagion, and now we've got customs duties going up through the roof. But you'll have seen many of these cycles before. Just give us a sense of what are the things that are worrying you now about the outlook for development? What are the things that keep you awake at night now?
Well, good afternoon. Welcome back to Washington. Great to be here. Now, your first question, what keeps me awake at night? I will tell you nothing. And basically for enlightened self-interest, if you have every day a conflict and you can no longer sleep, you can also no longer focus on the problems. So I think you need to keep also as somebody in management, you need to keep a healthy balance between dealing with the problems, but also to stay physically and mentally healthy. So therefore sleep. But I'm serious on that because sometimes people say you have to wake up. Now, what is then the more important question, what you raised, of what are the concerns? Clearly, we have gone through waves of Cold War. We have had seen wars. We have seen conflicts. We have seen pandemics. You have seen all sorts of things, coup d'etats. And so, so this has happened in the past. I think where there is a dimension that concerns me, and I think that should concern you as colleagues, is multilateralism is far more under threat than I would say ever before since 1945. And that should be a concern. This is not only to look at oneself as the World Bank, but more broadly speaking, the whole system as such. And yes, there are things that can be done better. We should not do as if everything is perfect, but we should also clearly recognize that there are issues that we cannot solve alone. And that are issues that can be related to peace, can be related to climate change, can be related to pandemics. There are things where you simply need international cooperation. And that sense of awareness, but also the willingness to act together, is being increasingly questioned. And that would concern me. Therefore, I just want to address all of you as parliamentarians. I feel that that is a key role of you. In the sense to keep actually these ideas alive with your colleagues in all parliaments, wherever you are sitting, but also to see that is actually enlightened self-interest and that there is actually a fighting chance that we can do things collectively better than alone.
Yeah. Well, the program that you've helped drive through here at the World Bank has increased its firepower to rise up to new times. And we did have a moment of that solidarity at the end of last year with the replenishment of IDA, which was a good thing. I mean, possibly we needed to raise more, but it was a good thing that we raised what we did. How do you foresee the mobilization of IDA now unfolding? And do you think there is still a case for especially donor countries to carry on the work of trying to build an even bigger balance sheet for the World Bank for the future?
So there are two dimensions. First, about the AIDA. And let me say that many of the countries that you are representing were key in securing a successful conclusion of the negotiations. These were over 60 donors. And then, of course, the bar representatives also bringing their input in it. I think in terms of the contributions, there have been also I just got distracted, sorry. In terms of the contributions, it is usually that the G7 are the largest. They bring about 60% of the total contributions. The OECD is actually over 90%. Where we are struggling is with still to get emerging markets up much more, and that there is a broader participation. And this time around, as you know, we had it successfully concluded to 100 billion, but as you know, the United States is reviewing its $4 billion pledge. So we haven't received the answer yet. At the same time, we have the package approved by the board and now also by the board of governors. So huge thank you. And I think the packages will come in your direction for approval in the different parliaments. And I think that is actually a very good signal of working together. And we need this desperately to continue. I think that on the future, I think there will be a lot of discussions about all these funds, multilateral funds, whether they either serve national interest, whether they are producing the necessary results, and whether things can be done differently, and for many donors maybe can we give less. Our case, we make strongly that we need to keep that level of engagement, if not higher. Why is that so? It is also clear that the SDGs are still way off track. There's a lot of money necessary. And so the 2030 agenda means that poverty will not have been reduced to 3% of the extreme poor. But unfortunately, we are still hovering around 8% or so. So there is still work to be done. And therefore, we will need that continued sense of solidarity. And I think, therefore, I would argue strongly that we need to keep that support. Now, can we discuss about content or financial terms and all the things? I think that should be all discussed. It has been also in this time around. I think that is good. As long as we keep on having there a good discussion, that is desirable. But the bottom line is that we should not give up on countries, low-income countries, Africa in particular. And I think it is a matter of the purpose of the bank. I mean, when you come here into the this building, you see that our dream is a world free of poverty. We're not there. So to do that, it is a, and then on a livable planet, we need also to make sure that it stays livable. So those things will require commitment, ambition, and ultimately the willingness to give.
Yeah, perfect. Let's open it up for questions. Who has got questions? While people are thinking about that, okay, let me start with Sierra Leone, the bank.
Thank you very much. I want to take him up on his last comment that the banks drive towards getting a world free of poverty. I think that's a very Herculean task. It's a task that is almost impossible, taking the current global dynamics and the fact that from our continent in Africa, every part of the continent is in war. We are either faced with war or we are faced with military coups across Africa. How can we fit into the plan of the bank when most of the countries in Africa are in significant debt distress? How does the bank going to roll out a new agenda for creating jobs to meet the emerging job market in Africa, and how these jobs would be fitting into the African plans and overall SDGs, and how the World Bank has assessed the success of the MDGs. So my concern is coming from Africa is the fact that the current global trend is not helping the cause to reduce poverty in Africa.
So
thank you. Why don't you take that, and then I'll bring in Latvia, Guinea, and Nigeria. Do you mind if I just come to Latvia first?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, you're good.
Thank you. I wanted to actually ask this question in the previous session, but I think it's equally appropriate to ask it now as well.
Yeah.
And it concerns the question on Ukraine, and it's about a potential for a source of funding that I think we haven't really discussed. And it's a question that's currently ongoing. There's a debate about that currently in Europe, and it's about the potential of confiscating assets, the Russian assets that are frozen or immobilized. And it's a difficult debate, I understand, but I was wondering whether the World Bank has a position on it, whether it would support confiscating these assets and giving them to Ukraine.
Great question. And so just so we're super clear, this is not just about confiscating the interest payment. This is actually about confiscating the asset itself.
The actual underlying asset.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Yeah, perfect. Nigeria?
Thank you very much. My real worry is the fact that we don't have the data in Africa. So what is the World Bank doing? Because there are lots of issues that we have to respond to if we must develop. And no one can help Africa except we have the data platform. So the data is real issue. So we keep having lots of projections here and there, but we don't really have the actual data. Can the World Bank or the IMF help to create platforms by which we can actually build Africa Data Bank so that we can access a lot of information that is necessary for development, because we must respond to issues like AI, artificial intelligence, and all that. Where will Africa be in 10 years' time without data? Thank you.
Perfect. Let's start with that, and then we'll do a second round.
Okay, thank you. Let me get to the question of the colleague from Sierra Leone. First, on the poverty, I think I always also take a step back from where we are, where we are today, and where we have to go. Let's never forget that, like 60 years ago, the whole world was 60% was extreme poor. We have basically since the early 2000s brought this down from about 30% to today 8%. So the goal, the SDG goal is 3%. And we will likely not achieve that. So that's never good. But we need also to put an historical perspective that we have over time made an enormous amount of progress. And yes, that can be challenged by war and by also the fact that there are other problems, economic problems, including the debt problem. I think we need to see that clearly. The bank is as concerned about any conflict, and we have seen that the number of fragile states have been increasing. That's also the reason why in the IDA there is so much support. I mean, we have essentially over the last 5-6 years tripled our support to fragile countries. And that support remains strong. At the same time, what we of course hope is that there are other mechanisms in place, because we are not in charge of that fosters a peaceful outcome of these conflicts. And that is a problem. What we have, however, and I want to be quite emphatic, while many have been withdrawing from Africa, the World Bank has not. And just to let you know that if you are looking what has happened to IDA, just to say, in 2000, 15% of our resources went to Africa. And that was about 3 billion. Today, it's about 40-45%, or about $33 billion per year to Africa. If you look at the IDA, it's 70%. So if you have a deal of 100 billion, 70 billion is going to Africa. Nobody else is doing this. We are the only ones who have been increasing, and it's the only one who's bringing concessional resources, which is also a problem, because non-concessional resources are adding to your debt problem. IDA is not, because we have highly concessional. These are loans that go up to 50 years. And then we have about 20%, or like $20 billion in grants. So, I mean, we have been responding to this, and this is a general issue that we would like basically see countries engaged. That gets me also to the debt problem. We have been very clear that particularly in the low-income countries, we should try to ensure positive net transfers. Our net disbursements only on IDA are in the 28 billion, no, $20 billion. The commitments are in to Africa and IDA, 28 billion. That basically allow you for net transfers in the order of $18 billion. Nobody else is doing this. The problem what we are seeing is that many creditors are taking the money out. We cannot compensate for that. But it is, I recognize, an issue. Another issue is that the terms are often too hard, and that are high interest or shorter maturities. But they are not limited only to foreign debt. Increasingly, African countries are confronted with a domestic debt problem. In quite a lot of countries, Nigeria is also an example, the domestic debt is a big issue. In some of the countries, it is the majority of the debt problem. That makes also the debt workouts so difficult. Why? Because creditors are looking at equitable treatment, meaning if you have to give a concession, everybody needs to give the concession. The problem with domestic debt, however, is that many African countries have also these very fragile financial systems. So if you were to impose an incredible haircut on this, it will affect the incipient insurance company, the incipient pension funds. So one has to be very, very careful to design programs that basically doesn't cause more harm than good. And that is one issue. The second issue is clearly the changing external creditor landscape. I dealt and managed the HIPC initiative. At that time, it were mainly Paris Club creditors that needed to give the debt relief. while the commercial debt was usually in arrears and was buybacked at 90-95% discounts. So that was, unquote, easy. Today, that is more difficult with, performing Eurobond debt with new creditors, mainly non-Paris Club creditors, being often the majority. So you need to actually see how you can get together. And that is a challenge. That's the reason why the Saudis, during their G20 presidency, created this common framework to see how we bring all those external actors together. And it has not been an easy process. It should be quicker, but it is certainly a serious effort to bring all the creditors together. Also, we have the Global Sovereign Debt Roundtable that's chaired by the G20, by the IMF and the World Bank, and has all the key creditors and the beneficiary countries of debt relief around the table. What I've concluded, and where also you can help enormously, is having dealt now over 30 years with debt relief, the best way to avoid anything is radical transparency. I do think that parliamentarians should know all the debt situation, that you know what is being contracted, that parliaments can discuss what is there and what are the implications on the debt sustainability, and that there is adequate oversight. I prefer that the parliaments do that, and not that, certainly, I don't think that the World Bank or anybody else should have a policing function. What I think is you should have strengthened parliamentarian control and oversight processes that can discuss on a permanent basis how your external debt or the general debt strategy fits within fiscal policy, fits within your priorities, because you may want to have indeed debts that are very important for infrastructure undertakings or for electricity, whatever. And I think that it would be very healthy that you discuss that. I think it is often not accessible. Yeah. And that should be actually changed, because I think this will help you in the discussions with the government, because the ultimate interest when you talk about Nigeria is Nigeria's welfare and that you succeed. But then how do you use that money as effectively as possible without creating the next debt crisis? That is important. So we have, of course, the debtor reporting system, and that you have the general debt data, and I think that should absolutely be used. But I'm suggesting that be as transparent as possible. You should know all the terms. What I'm suggesting is, well, why don't you do that, what the World Bank is doing? When you contract a loan, that loan is published on the website, how much and all the terms. Why do you think this is normal to know from the World Bank? Why don't you ask that you should know that from every other creditor? I don't understand that. Because I think this is where your parliamentarian functions are going to be one of the most important and consequential, particularly economically speaking, for many of you. So that is what I would say. The last question on Latvia, on Ukraine. First on the support. So the bank has been supporting Ukraine since the very beginning of the outbreak of the war. And we were basically within 10 days after February 24th, 22, we were at the board with a support program. So we have been providing different support. We have been providing to the World Bank Group on our own account, be it IBRD, we had even IDA, we have IFC. So we have used the different balance sheets. On top of that, we have received guarantees by countries that allowed us to go over and beyond our normal exposure on this. Then we have also had trust funds where countries have contributed to this. And then we have had the financial intermediary fund. So with all those funds together and our own, we have made commitments, I think in the order of 77 billion, of which 53 billion were dispersed. The largest, of course, contributions were made by the United States, as we have provided their economic support through these vehicles. And so that has a... Now, on the second question on confiscating, I'm also an economic historian. I look at all those things. I read about this. Needless to say, that is loaded to the extreme. I think that certainly there are, as you have seen, two dimensions is the capturing of interest on frozen assets and that largely because of Euroclear. And then there is the step further is that you confiscate on this. As you know, there are a never-ending list of also legal questions about this. It's very, very difficult, but that is a discussion. We don't get involved in this because clearly this is something that the countries will have to figure that out. We know the positions, so it's not that we don't look at this, but as an international institution, we don't get into this type of debates. Other than that, we of course know that it is ongoing.
Perfect. Thank you very much. Right, let's go to Kenya, and then Guinea, and then Italy, and Ghana. Kenya.
Thank you so much. My name is Jematia. I have a few questions, and I want to speak as a politician and a young Kenyan. I am an African, grown, brought up in Africa. I have never lived in the West. But every time, my life depends so much in World Bank, IMF, the West, which dictates many things. I want to know reasons why World Bank gives Africa money every year in, every year out. We are not able to pay most of these grants and monies, but why are you continually giving us? Two, it is not possible to do trade and give us all the tariffs and loans because Africa is a continent fragmented into countries that is not able to work and function because it is controlled by many factors. So even if we sit here every day, and I like the way we are trying to be very, try and get solutions, people don't understand Africa. I am a young African, but I think I will die old not seeing Africa being progressive enough because the system that created Africa the way it is becoming, is not helping. And we are here today, as much as we want to ask World Bank to give us solutions. For instance, why can't we have a factory that manufacture like irrigation in Africa, that World Bank can fund these monies, help these Africans get what they all the food they get, export, build Africa, get your money back, and make this continent move. Instead of giving money to executives that are not able to deliver, come back, give programs that you decide in Washington, and I am supposed to implement in Nairobi, as much as it is negotiated through my government, but it is not practical. Because what people see and what is reality is different in Africa. Two, we have a lot of minerals.
Can I just ask you to be really brief, just because we've got 10 minutes and I've got four people to get in.
Exactly.
Thanks.
So lastly, most of the programs that you give us, what happens when is not achieved? Is it supposed to be a blame back to Africans or countries, or we should also consider World Bank being part of the problem, because it is a cycle that goes back and back all the time?
Okay, perfect. Thank you so much. Kinney.
Alors,
thank you. Thank you, everyone. I'm Honora Camara, and I am president of the Finance Commission of the Parliament of Guinea. My intervention has to do with the question of economic growth. Now, you can well understand that the brunt of African countries have mining resources, have extractive resources. Guinea is a good example, and I use that as an example. You can't have economic growth in Africa when you cannot transform, process your raw material and in finished products. So the processing part is very important. Extraction involves three steps: extraction, transportation, and processing, transformation to which. And in my country, in our countries, those companies, enterprises that extract and transform have generated taxes, but we don't control that. We don't have any control over that, nor over transportation. And these resources, minerals, are not processed in our countries either. So when we're talking about getting support or giving support to third world countries in this respect, that support not only has to be for workforce and for labor, but also for most raw material extracted and produced in these countries be processed in the same country for the added value to be generated and garnered by said countries. Pressure exerted on our countries, that's my second question. You'll understand, third world countries have budget deficits that are significant. Fiscal deficits are big because most of the eligible admissible charges, they represent approximately 70-80% of the budget. So it goes without saying, and it is well understandable, that the citizens of Guinea, France, Guinea, Morocco, USA, live the same realities. They need a certain degree of well-being. Now there is too much pressure from the government and fiscal deficit in this case, which is significant. In a specific case, there should be an allowance to those countries to get into more debt. It is the conditionalities according to which loans are provided, reimbursement, and of course the efficiency of the public sector that come into play in this equation. So, countries that you grant loans to would have different categories, 6, 7, 8, and we get into higher and higher debt, and debt gets more and more costly. And so the support has to be given in this respect and with that in mind, so that infrastructures can be built, roads can be built, energy infrastructures can be built. What about agriculture? There are problems in this sector.
That's great. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Let me go to Italy.
Donc, je disais, je vais me résumer.
As I was saying, and I will summarize.
Just because we are out of time. Can I go to Italy, please?
Hello.
Okay. Merci beaucoup.
Merci.
Thank you.
Quick question. I don't know how the contract or the agreements between the World Bank and the single countries work, but maybe one clause in these agreements could be that the governments should refer to the parliaments in specific hearings about how they use the funds, et cetera, like we are doing for the recovery fund in the European Union, in order to start giving, in a certain extent, transparency to all the operation related to these distributed funds. Maybe it's not the solution, but I think if this comes from the World Bank, it could be good. Thank you.
Great, right.
Okay, let me start with the Kenyan question. Why would the World Bank give to Africa or to Kenya money? Look, we are not a commercial bank. We're not going to, or an investment bank, to chase and make money. What we are trying to do is, I want to go back, the World Bank is about development, it's about poverty reduction, it is about welfare, that can be in the health, education, it can be in the infrastructure. That is our goal. And I think, quite frankly, over the decades, we have actually been making progress. Are you steady in progress? No, because basically there are countries that have fallen into wars, there have been catastrophes. So if you are looking at it, it has not been easy, but it's also not that the World Bank has created. There have been many homegrown problems. And one needs to recognize this. I would also say that if you say that Africa is fragmented, well, if I look in Europe, it's pretty fragmented as well. So, I mean, that is the realities that we are facing with nation states. I think what is important here is that we are not, and that is again sometimes the position, that we are here sitting here at a computer and device a lending program for Kenya or any country. Nothing could be further from the truth. 60% of our operational staff is in the field. In Nairobi is a regional hub, 800 people. The country director is in Nairobi, talks with the government, and what we are trying to find is what are the priorities of the country that we can support. It is not here that somebody is sitting and predetermining. If that were to be the case, we go the wrong way. We don't do that in it. What we also would like to have is that there is the ownership of the government. It doesn't make sense that we want this if the government doesn't want it. So we're pretty clear on that, that we are not going to make here unilateral decisions here in Washington. I also think is that we, and I've been saying, is we provide to low-income countries concessional money. Again, what I would like to say, concessional money is not market-related money. You don't pay 10% interest on World Bank loans. On the IDA loans, there is a 0.75% cover charge. You can get it in there, partly for 40, 50 years, depending on which country it is. Then there are countries that can access IBRDs, then they become blend countries, so they can blend that depending on where they are in the development. And countries that are having a real hard time, they will get grants. So we are not we have differentiated, and what I again want to state is we try to make sure that countries get positive flows. And so that basically there is an also recognition that countries will need international support. And the alternative is, and there countries will need to work on, is domestic resource mobilization. If countries prefer not to have it, then you will need to generate that through your own tax effort and others, which is a challenge in many countries because the vast majority of the low-income countries have taxation levels below 15%. And so that is where some problems come. Many even below 10%, it becomes very difficult to finance the function of the state. On the Guinean question of the mining industry is absolutely important. And the transformation, we agree on this. I think what we have tried to support also countries in the negotiations between the government and mining companies, because sometimes countries have not the legal armies that some of these companies have. And sometimes there is an asymmetry in the negotiation power. And we very much support that there is all the possibility explored on transformation, but also to get the royalties right. And we know from past experience that unfortunately sometimes these deals didn't favor the country. And clearly, again, what we would favor is to be as transparent as possible, because this are for generations the wealth for the countries. And with that, you can actually build the country from infrastructure to health to education. Again, on the budget deficits, everybody has deficits, but you need to see how you keep the deficit on a sustainable basis and how you finance it. Again, what we are saying is you need to look at the debt sustainability, and very often the terms with which debt is contracted is not consistent with debt sustainability, and that's a problem. And what we have favored is you need to build very good debt management system, not only the registration, but also that there is a team calculating how the debt fits within the fiscal policy and then in the overall macro policy, so that actually there are no bad surprises. An interesting idea I've also, and you may be interested in that, I've seen it in quite a few European countries, but not only, also other OECD countries, that governments have actually independent debt commissions. So they have then people, professors or somebody from the financial sector, but also international experts, and they look at the debt situation from a macro till how bond issues are well done. And they I've seen that, for example, in Austria, I think New Zealand had that. And these are actually very, I think, very helpful commissions, because they give then on an ongoing basis advice to government how you can at least manage this prudently and also highlight where there are weaknesses. So I think these are good practices, and I think I would certainly advise people to look at these experiences. This is not the World Bank, but this is these are great experiences, and maybe also in this group, you could share those. On the Italian question about contracts, first I have to come back to this, is we are not a political institution that we can put one thing after the other in a contract, what we like or not like. But what you are talking about accountability, the use of funds, that is, of course, is the investment operations, is guaranteed, because every component is pre-identified and there is accountability for the procurement. So we can actually double check, and if it is not correct, we can actually go after this if there was corruption or irregularities that you announced misprocurement. So that is being done. Now, having said this, I think, again, I think what the bank has learned with all its operations, we would welcome that whatever loan you conclude, there is nothing to hide of a World Bank loan. I think that, and we publish the document, and if people feel that that is useful, that is okay. Now, one other thing is, if parliaments think, and that has always to be done with in consultation with the government, if they want us to brief at a time a parliamentarian committee, we will do that. What we will not do is to do it independently. I've been myself country director. I know exactly that in some countries, they will not allow you to talk because they have the privilege of the dialogue between the Ministry of Finance or Ministry to do so. You have to respect that. But if the government feels that it is useful to have a discussion, I don't see any reason why you should resist. I actually, myself, I have been in this, and I welcome that. Mm-hmm. There's nothing to hide. And if people have criticism, then let's hear that. But Accountability is key. And for us, why is it also important? Is because we get so much support from donors. And that allows us to have a very substantive envelope for AIDA. We want to continue to have that. And I think that type of accountability you were just mentioning would help, in my mind, the World Bank and by extension the countries to make sure that we can have the maximum amount possible in replenishments. Because that is for certain, and having done 4 AIDA replenishments, it gives a higher level of comfort to the donors that they are not going to be confronted with questions in their parliaments that what are you doing, etc. So if that can be facilitated, and maybe through your parliamentarian network, we would welcome that. Let me also say the last thing. I think it would be great if parliamentarians, when they visit countries, and particularly AIDA countries, why don't you let us know and that you would like to have a briefing, or if you have extra time, that we show you a project and you may have some preferences, just let us know. Because for us, the highest level of comfort that you know that the money is well spent, that we're getting results, that we are doing that in a collaborative manner and an accountable manner is absolutely key, absolutely for the success of AIDA and the future of our partnership.
Perfect. That's a great note on which to end. So accountability is key. That is definitely something that comes up in our network time and time again. So that is definitely a priority that we can take forward. And that offer on briefing on AIDA countries and the programs, absolutely right. Seeing really is believing. That concludes this session. We got one more session before coffee. And that session is going to be with the IMF. But please join me in giving a huge thanks to Axel for today and for all of the support he gives to the Parliamentary Network. Axel, thank you.